The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
But we really have a lot more of a question if somehow we have to go to the speaker or the pro tem in the case of incapacitation. Let's say both are incapacitated, both sick, or the one office is vacant and somebody's sick. There are all sorts of problems. We remember briefly hearing about them in the Reagan shooting with Al Haig and the controversy whether he was in charge or not. But the simple point is, it doesn't make a lot of sense to think of the Speaker of the House coming over temporarily to take over for the president, act as president for maybe a few hours or days, and then lose your job, lose your position in the House, and not be able to go back to that as the president resumes power. So I think that's one that today, with the Boris Johnson being sick, with the possibility of presidential illness being upon us, that we really should rethink having Congress in the line of succession, and particularly for this question of, in the case of incapacitation, maybe we should go more to a cabinet line of succession, which would have much more ease of continuity.
I'm Molly Reynolds, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, June 17th, 2020. In this episode, I talk to Norm Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute and John Fortier of the Bipartisan Policy Center about the Continuity of Government Commission, an effort they helped lead beginning in 2002 to ensure that our three branches of government would be able to function after a catastrophic attack that killed or incapacitated large numbers of our legislators, executive branch officials, or judges. We discuss the findings of the commission, how they relate to the challenges facing the federal government today, and how the various branches of government have or have not acted to ensure smooth operations during the COVID-19 pandemic. It's the Lawfare Podcast, June 17th. Norm Ornstein and John Fortier on the continuity of government. So let's just start with the basics. What was the Continuity of Government Commission, and what led you to take part in standing it up?
So I'll start. I began to think about these issues on 9/11 itself. I had actually been driving out to Dulles Airport that morning, a beautiful, clear day, and got called off the jetway when the second plane hit the World Trade Center, when it became clear this was not just some stray private plane that had gone off course. I went back home and watched the mayhem. And later that afternoon, when the plane United 93 crashed in Pennsylvania, it became clear to me that if it had not left Newark 45 minutes late, the passengers on board would not have known it was a suicide mission. The plane was headed very likely for the Capitol Dome, and it could have caused a terrible problem, in particular one where a majority of members of Congress were dead or missing. We would be below the quorum requirement in the Constitution for half the members to do any official business. And at the worst possible time, we would not have a Congress functioning. So I started to think about and then write about continuity in Congress. Brian Baird, a congressman from Washington State, who had been caught up in the Capitol at that time and in the chaos that followed, had some of the same ideas, got in touch. We began to work on some of these issues. And before very long, and I wrote a couple of pieces on this, one in the Washington Post, I got contacted by Lloyd Cutler, who had been, of course, counsel to two presidents, one of the most distinguished lawyers of the 20th century. And he said, we need to do something about this, and recommended the creation of a commission, which made a lot of sense to us. We began to seek out and got some funding to pull it off. Asked Alan Simpson, one of the great public servants as well, a former assistant Republican leader in the Senate, to be a co-chair with Lloyd. And John came on board as executive director.
Great. So I want to start by just kind of talking about what the commission looked at. And over the course of its life, you looked at all three branches of government. So let's start by talking about Congress, you know, the branch that's nearest and dearest to my heart. That's where the commission started. So why was that the first branch that you tackled? And what were some of the key issues that were on the table when you looked at continuity of Congress?
Well, Noor mentioned some of his travels to the airport, but you know, we have to remember also that we did suspect on the day of 9/11 and later confirmed with the 9/11 Commission that that flight, United 93, was headed back to the Capitol. And of course, also a plane hit the Pentagon. So we knew 9/11 was not just an attack on our economic institutions, a great loss of life, but it was also an attack on the institutions of government that were going to be necessary to respond to the attack. And so the Congress issue was in the forefront. Norm wrote a piece very shortly after called "What If Congress Were Obliterated?" That put a real fine point on it. And we started to really think about what would happen if many people in Congress were killed or incapacitated, and what the institution could do to come back from that, and whether there were limitations constitutionally legally to do so. And I mean, the simple answer is we found that there were. And we did spend some time, Lloyd Cutler certainly came in not so long after this, but we did spend some time really delving into some of the legal, constitutional House and Senate precedents and rules to really get at this. And you know, one thing we found out only late in the process was, you know, we had had some of these conversations back in the Cold War, that these things were contemplated. What if there were a nuclear attack or some sort of suitcase bomb in Washington, D.C.? How would we deal with this? And in fact, Congress even passed, the Senate passed constitutional amendments that were meant to address this sort of thing. We had some different recommendations at the end, but you know, this was a question that had been asked of the Cold War and been completely forgotten. And then here we are on 9/11, potentially being faced with a situation with not only a crisis, but one where our institutions were disabled and unable to respond to it.
So one of the things that you talk about in the report on Congress that I want to ask about specifically, because I think it's particularly relevant to these issues in the current moment, is this question of mass vacancies in Congress versus the potential for incapacitated members. So can one of you kind of walk through those two issues and how they are similar or different, and what that kind of means for us thinking about these issues at this moment?
So on incapacitation, of course, there's a real distinction here that we have with the House and Senate, but we also know that we've had examples of incapacitation in both houses before. Gladys Spellman, a member of the House, had a massive stroke, was incapacitated for a significant period of time. Congress could have expelled Gladys Spellman, but didn't, and with 435 members, the one vacancy with her just simply not being there didn't mean as much. We had it in the Senate with Carl Mundt, for example, a senator from South Dakota, who was comatose for a very long period of time. But it's one thing with individuals and another with larger numbers. Now, if members die, most states have a provision in the Senate for governors to appoint interim senators until the next general election to fill out the remainder of a term. The House doesn't have anything like that. And when we thought about the possibility that became quite vivid in the aftermath of 9/11, we had the anthrax scare that hit the Senate. And we did have some people, not senators themselves, who were hit with anthrax. We had to bring up the possibility that we could have very large numbers of the Senate incapacitated, and therefore, its ability to fill those slots would be an impossibility. And remember that even if you took the extreme step of expelling people who were incapacitated just so you could have enough members to operate, it takes a two-thirds vote of the Senate. If you didn't have a quorum to begin with, you couldn't even do that. And you simply wouldn't have a Senate for what could be many, many months at a time. So we looked at that issue in some ways separately. The problem of large numbers of members being killed is that in the House of Representatives, you have special elections. The only way that we have for filling seats in the House is by election. But we know that even in normal times, when we have a vacancy in the House, a special election takes on average 4 months to pull off. And it's not like you could move it to within a matter of days without completely distorting the impact of what an election's supposed to be, where voters look at alternatives and choose the one who's best. You wouldn't have primaries. You wouldn't have an easy way of selecting candidates. You wouldn't have much of a campaign. So we had to balance and juggle both of those, recognizing that we could treat the House differently than the Senate when it came to deaths, but that we had to also consider the question of incapacitation in a much larger scale when it came to the Senate. And to do both of those, we had to come up with a conclusion that required, we believed, and our commission believed, a constitutional amendment that under extreme circumstances would allow for emergency interim appointments.
So I'm glad that you brought up this proposal for a constitutional amendment, and you mentioned sort of the fact that it would only be applicable in extreme circumstances. And so I'm curious also to hear you both talk a little bit about the commission's thinking around what constitutes an emergency. So you discuss a little bit in the report on continuity of Congress, making sure that any procedures here are only used under emergency conditions. And I think this is a concern that we've heard some in this current context as we think about continuity. So how do you make sure whatever procedures get put in place, in this case, potentially for having temporary replacements, that sort of thing, how do you make sure that that's only used in the case of an emergency as opposed to used in the case of all arising vacancies? Kind of how did you tackle that question?
Well, first, just to add to Norm's answer before, the one other piece of this that really was going to make Congress operating prove difficult was the quorum requirement. And the quorum in the Constitution is pretty clear. It says each body, the House and the Senate, shall have a majority of its members required a quorum. And the founders debated this. They didn't want a low quorum. They wanted to make sure that a majority of the country was there, represented before any business was taking place. Now, there were some precedents over the years which the House and Senate used to, if there were a member or two, the seat or two vacant, that they chipped away at that. But really, our worry was, you know, we could have a Congress that would not operate at all, especially the House in Norm's scenario where there were lots of deaths, or perhaps the House and the Senate in the case of lots of incapacitation. So it wasn't just that we were worried about the distortion of Congress, which we were, but we were really worried about Congress not operating. And we can get to some of the things that other people proposed, and I would say that they were inadequate compared to our recommendations, which was, you know, a constitutional amendment, which is very hard to do. But you know, they essentially tried to allow the House to operate just with a few people. And you know, that to us was also problematic, either just a few people around, nobody represented in most places, or not having enough to have a quorum. And so we had to think, well, you know, is there a threshold that we want to have this kick in? And for us, this was such a big change that it didn't make sense to have the House replace members temporarily in the ordinary course of business. We have vacancies all the time. We have 2, 3, 4, 5 vacancies. People resign, people die, things happen. And you know, it's a big change for a constitutional amendment. So we thought of a threshold that we wanted it only in the case where it was really going to affect the operation of the body, that they couldn't have a quorum and they couldn't operate. Sure, there might be some scenarios where 50 or 70 members were killed. That's a very bad thing. It could also change the majorities in the House or Senate. But we really tried to limit this to allowing that Congress to operate as opposed to not operate at all, with a legitimate quorum holding a Congress for the time that was needed until we could get the people back in place.
So We've talked a little bit about Congress. I want to turn now to talking a little bit about the presidency. So the commission's work on the presidency is focused largely on issues of presidential succession. So why did you see that as kind of the central issue there? And what were some of the what are some of the issues that come up with potential continuity of the presidency?
So let me start with first a little bit of history, which also is informative because it tells us that the resistance that we've gotten to action in these critical areas from Congress and the other branches is not new. And we've had in the past three presidential succession processes. One right from the beginning that was changed in the 19th century, and then again in 1947. But we didn't get the change in the 19th century until we had a couple of periods, very dangerous ones, where there was no ability to replace a vice president, where the those in the line of succession for the presidency were the president pro tempore of the Senate and the Speaker of the House. But periods when we had a president, no vice president, and for months, no speaker or president pro tem of the Senate. And only after a second assassination did Congress get jolted into altering that process. The last time we had a Presidential Succession Act, 1947, was because then President Harry Truman, who of course also had no vice president, because there was no way of creating one after Franklin Roosevelt had died when he succeeded to the presidency, had gone with the Secretary of State, Stettinius, overseas at a time right after the war when it was pretty dangerous, and recognized that we really needed to update the act, and managed to get the Congress, the one, by the way, that he called the Do-Nothing Congress in 1947, to make a significant change in presidential succession. Among other things, after members of Congress had been taken out of the line of succession in the previous act, he put them back in, but reversed the order so that the first was the Speaker of the House, followed by the President pro tem of the Senate. Truman believed that he wanted to be closer to the people, something that many consider highly questionable, having members of Congress in the line, followed by the cabinet in order of the creation of the office. But it was an act that, one, was built on a belief that you could have everybody in the line of succession in Washington, and the worst thing that would happen is that there could be some kind of a nuclear attack, but you'd have notice, and you could get people away from the Capitol, get the president or get members of the cabinet into secure bunkers. And we know that there was a secret bunker at the Greenbrier Resort south of Washington for members of Congress. That didn't fit the 9/11 era reality, where you could have an instant attack and one that could destroy all of Washington. And the only provision that had been made otherwise was this informal one that at the State of the Union message, where the president, vice president, the cabinet, and every other leader was there congregated in the Capitol, in the chamber of the House, that one of the cabinet members would be in a secret location away from the Capitol, an undisclosed location, ready to step in if some utter catastrophe happened. We believe that the Presidential Succession Act of 1947 was obsolete because it only had people in Washington in the line of succession, but also that it included a lot of people who shouldn't be in the line of succession. Members of the cabinet, for example, chosen not because they were ready to be president, but to fulfill other qualities, a substantive expertise in something like agriculture or regional or ethnic or other considerations, but also that it was highly questionable to have members of Congress in the line of succession as well. And one other big flaw, which is that the Speaker of the House could assume the presidency if the president and vice president were no longer with us, but would have to resign from the office. But if the Speaker decided not to do that, at any subsequent time, the Speaker could resign and preempt whoever had taken over, which was a flaw built in on a belief that maybe at the time the disaster occurred with the president, the speaker would be unavailable and he needed somebody else to step in temporarily. So lots of flaws and lots of problems, and that got us to consider, given that we could have a complete catastrophe in Washington, the worst being at the time of an inaugural, that we needed to really reconsider how to do presidential succession.
So you've put a lot of great issues on the table. I want to sort of highlight a couple of them and also allow John to come in here. So one thing that you mentioned, Norm, is one of the flaws in the thinking of the Presidential Succession Act around these issues is the fact that, you know, everyone in the line works in D.C. And I would say that one thing that I think we've been seeing in the current moment is that this has consequences for executive branch operations, too, when we think about continuity in a broader sense. And something that comes up in the report is also this notion that acting secretaries are in the line of succession. And given that we've seen in the Trump administration this increased reliance on actings, less on sort of cabinet level positions, but certainly folks below that, the kind of interaction of changing political circumstances with some of these issues. So those are just a couple things that really sort of continue to strike me about what the commission wrote about on these issues. But I'll let John come in because I know you also have some thoughts, particularly on some of this presidential succession stuff.
Sure. And as Norm mentioned, look, I think the big worry we had was the Succession Act is not perfect, but in the case of a single death or very orderly death and then another death, that much of it makes sense. But in the case of a mass attack where we have the president and vice president killed or incapacitated or multiple people, there were a number of problems in the act. And Norm pointed out one, just the key one, I think, for us was that the members of Congress being aligned in succession, while Harry Truman had a good reason for wanting them to be aligned, they're elected. One, there's a question of whether that's constitutional. We thought it wasn't. But two, you could have a change in party, and you could really have some very confusing scenarios. Norm mentioned one of the speaker bumping someone out, and cabinet succession is a lot smoother, where someone can come from the cabinet and go to the presidency and then return with the same party with that sort of continuity there. You asked about the line of succession being in D.C. That was an issue for us. Of course, we're thinking about a mass attack and everybody being here. But, you know, it was hard for us to figure, well, who would those people be? And we decided to, you know, be a little flexible and think about allowing a president to appoint some people with Senate confirmation to just be somewhere else. Now, those people didn't necessarily have a real position. And so you'd want to make sure they were somewhat connected to Washington, but you also had to make sure they were outside. So we saw that as an ultimate backstop. On the question of acting secretaries, you know, there are a number of these smaller questions about the line when you start to look into it. It probably weren't that well thought out. And in fact, with the Brookings Institution here in mind, I wrote a piece long ago in the last issue of the Brookings Review entitled How the President of Brookings Might Have Become the President of the United States. And that involved this question of acting secretaries. Without getting into too many of the details, the president at the time, Michael Armacost, had been the number three position at the State Department. He had at the inauguration, when, as Norm noted, there are all sorts of problems if something happens there because you don't have a new line of succession. You don't have the new people confirmed on at noon, new cabinet secretaries. The House and the Senate are there with the House and Senate leaders are there, so they might be killed. So you often have a period of time of a few hours, in that case in 1989, a few days, where there was nobody in the line of succession, essentially from the new administration, except you have people left over from the old administration. And Armacost, as the number three at state acting as secretary, was arguably in the line of succession to be president, someone who would not have been a household name. So that's, you know, a particular problem. One other thing I just want to highlight, which is, I think, relevant to today and thinking about the kinds of things that we might think about with a pandemic. We do have some protections for the incapacitation of the presidency. The 25th Amendment clarified a lot that was already in the original Constitution, how these things are transferred. But we really have a lot more of a question if somehow we have to go to the Speaker or the pro tem in the case of incapacitation. Let's say both are incapacitated, both sick, or the one office is vacant and somebody's sick. There are all sorts of problems. We remember briefly hearing about them in the Reagan shooting with Al Haig and the controversy whether he was in charge or not. But the simple point is, it doesn't make a lot of sense to think of the Speaker of the House coming over temporarily to take over for the president, act as president for maybe a few hours or days, and then lose your job, lose your position in the House, and not be able to go back to that as the president resumes power. So I think that's one that today, with the Boris Johnson being sick, with the possibility of presidential illness being upon us, that we really should rethink having Congress in the line of succession, and particularly for this question of, in the case of incapacitation, maybe we should go more to a cabinet line of succession, which would have much more ease of continuity.
So, Molly, let me mention a couple of things here. One is, unlike with the continuity of Congress, doing something about presidential succession does not require a constitutional amendment. The Constitution says that there will be a president and a vice president, and that presidential succession after that can be settled by Congress from among officers of the United States, with a capital O. That's one of the reasons many constitutional scholars are skeptical about having members of Congress in the line. They are not officers of the United States. A second point is that there's been a lot of thought given and a lot of action taken in the executive branch to succession within cabinet agencies and succession below the level of the chief executive. We know that even as we are speaking now, there are people who have authority who are secreted in bunkers away from Washington for each of the departments and agencies. They rotate back and forth so that if something catastrophic happened, there would be somebody with the legal authority to sign off on actions that would be taken by the government. When we did our continuity of government reports, Dick Cheney was the vice president of the United States. We actually met with Cheney in the vice president's office after our continuity of Congress report, and he was quite helpful. But when I tried to get the vice president to focus on presidential succession, I met with a stone wall. They were not really interested in dealing with that issue, and we haven't had much success after that. And finally, I would note that what we really came down on with presidential succession was not just stripping the members of Congress and thinking through the cabinet. What we wanted was to have, after the handful of cabinet members who you could think of as having the breadth to be able to step in as president, state, attorney general, treasury, defense, maybe homeland security, that we would have a group of additional people chosen from around the country, nominated by a president, confirmed in the same way that a vice president is under the 25th Amendment, as officers of the United States, whose duties would include getting briefings and being ready just in case. And those could include some of the most distinguished people in America with government experience. That would be a lot better than what we have now. That could be done by law. But the fact is, we've seen very little interest from members of Congress in both parties in the almost 20 years since 9/11 in dealing with these issues.
So I'm going to come back to that last issue you brought up, which is basically kind of what was the response to the work that you did and what were the obstacles to change in a minute. But first, I want to at least touch briefly on your report about continuity of the courts, which looks largely at the Supreme Court and principally around the idea of reconstituting the Supreme Court. And I'm just curious, sort of, why was that the focus? Why did you think that was kind of the central issue? And frankly, this is a set of recommendations where I wonder if you think that the way that things have changed in Congress with politics more broadly since you started this work, if that really affects the challenges of reconstituting the court in the face of a disaster.
Well, one story from 9/11 that's not as widely told is, of course, the Supreme Court, which is just across the street from the Capitol, the day of 9/11, the Chief Justice, William Rehnquist at the time, was presiding over the Judicial Conference, which was a, all the Supreme Court justices, plus all of the chief judges from all the circuits from across the country. And they were there and the meeting was going on, and someone came up and whispered something in Chief Justice Rehnquist's ear, and he got up, stood up and left, and nobody knew why. And it turns out he was taken away to an undisclosed location. And only after the judges were able to find out what was happening. So, I mean, the court physically is right there. And might have been hit in the same way that the Congress was. Now, we didn't view this as urgently as the others, and that the court is a decentralized institution. There are lower courts that are spread across the country, and there are a lot of mechanisms that one might use to reconstitute the court. But we did note that there is a quorum requirement in law on the court of six people to make decisions. We could imagine that in the immediacy of a disaster where really the Congress is wiped out and parts of the line of succession, that really the court might be called on to weigh in on something, maybe couldn't weigh in because of that. I mean, there are certainly ways that if the Senate were reconstituted quickly, the president might be able to appoint people very quickly and get them confirmed. That would take a little longer. He could make recess appointments. But, you know, we also noted all of the potential problems of, they're not legal, but political, that if the entire court were wiped out and a president then had the ability to appoint all nine justices because of that tragedy, that was something that we didn't have a remedy for, but also really cautioned against doing so rashly, especially in a time of a crisis.
So I would add that, of course, Now it's palpable in a different way. With that statutory requirement of a quorum of six justices, knowing that we have several justices who are over the age of 70, some over the age of 80, at a time when the coronavirus is particularly potent for people who are 70 or over, the possibility of several justices being incapacitated, but not removed from the court, could leave us without a Supreme Court. And as John suggested, there are times, and especially if this happened with some kind of a terrorist attack or another massive attack, where there are real legal and constitutional questions to be raised, the prospect of having 14 separate courts of appeals jumping up and offering contradictory advice with no real way of deciding which would prevail was not a particularly pleasant one to contemplate. So we worked through possibilities here for the Supreme Court itself. And the one that seemed to make the most sense, which also could be done by statute, was to create, in the event of a Supreme Court falling below its statutory quorum requirement, having an emergency interim court of appeals created by statute that would consist of the remaining Supreme Court justices and the chief judges of the appeals courts to operate until the Supreme Court could get back up to speed. We do have other emergency interim courts, the FISA court being one. So it's a feasible thing to do as a backstop. And we actually had some significant interest from the Constitution Subcommittee of the Judiciary Committee in the Senate that was then chaired by Dianne Feinstein, even to a point where they were drafting the bill, but it never got anywhere, as was the case with many of our recommendations.
So yeah, let's talk about that. So these reports that the commission released, the one on Congress came out in 2003, the one on the presidency in 2009, and the one on the courts in 2011, and it's 2020, and we're having this conversation. So I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about kind of how was the work received when you put it out, and what have been the major obstacles to change? Why are we still talking about this now, going on, 17 years since the first one of these reports was released?
Well, I do think that the response has been disappointing, and I'll mention briefly the court. Norm hinted at that there was some interest, and it didn't happen. In presidential succession, the bigger issues we addressed were not addressed, and it took many years just to add the Homeland Secretary to the line of succession, who was thrown at the end of the line of succession, just because that was how we always did it. But I think the greatest disappointment was on our recommendations in Congress, which were which were taken very seriously. And Congress knew it had a problem. And we really spent several years, very close to 9/11, debating this, both chambers. But at the end of the day, there was some resistance. And it was, you know, part of it was, we think, that members don't like to think about their own demise, or the demise of their chamber, and it's difficult. Part of it was, we really saw that we had to have a constitutional amendment. We needed appointments to be made to the House. We couldn't do that just by law. And of course, anybody in Congress would rather just pass a law or change the rule rather than go all the way to constitutional amendments. Hard to do. The opposition became political. It was a little bit from both sides, but certainly the leadership in the House at some point turned against it. The argument we were making was, we need a full Congress to operate in this terrible time where the institution has been decimated. And the counterargument sometimes was, well, we've never had anybody in the House of Representatives who's been appointed before. And that's a democratic value. And that perhaps it's, you know, elitist or some other reason of thinking that this recommendation would change the character of Congress. They, I think, tried to take some shortcuts to address this. They passed some bills looking to shorten the time you could have special elections to really tighten up that time. As Norm pointed out, it's not realistic to think that time can be, you know, very short. And so at least we're talking several months of no filling of those vacancies. And then they passed a what I think, which is still on the books, a problematic, I think unconstitutional change in the rules in the House, which lowered the quorum in sort of emergency situations. They imagined, what if a lot of members were incapacitated, couldn't show up. In that case, you could imagine only, you know, the 10 members of Congress who were left healthy showing up and saying, yeah, we're the Congress, we're the House of Representatives. We can then act, pass laws, act as the Congress in various ways with the other branches or the other bodies. And you know, that's still on the books today. And, you know, as I say, I think that is constitutionally very suspect. It's also potentially very dangerous to think about just a very small number of members of the House. And so they were trying to take these shortcuts. The debate went on a long time, and then it didn't happen. And again, to bring up something I brought up before, it reminded of the Cold War, where there was very serious debate about these things. 3 times the Senate passed constitutional amendments that did similar things to what we recommended, not with the incapacitation, but with the vacancies. And the House, again, did not take them up. So it got closer. And ultimately, when people like Estes Kefauver, who were the proponents of these things, left Congress, the issue died out so much so that by 9/11, we had forgotten about it. There was no one with living history of it. We had to find it in, you know, obscure places and realize that this history had happened. And I fear that that has happened again today. We have a crisis of a different sort, which we're starting to think about some of these things, and I hope we do address them. But it was disappointing that the House really did not take up the things that would really preserve its own continuity at a time where it was really needed, you know, right after a crisis that pointed out those flaws.
So just to add to that, you know, one of the problems here is that Congress, just as a general matter, as we know, has an enormous amount of inertia. And getting it to act when there isn't an immediate need, if you're dealing with a theoretical issue, is always difficult. And that's the history, as John has recounted so well, of action in these areas, not just in the aftermath of the Cold War, but even going back to the 19th century. Another reason is fundamental human nature. I've thought a lot about how many people I know, smart, educated, thoughtful people with young children, don't do wills, even though they are traveling together. And if something happened, if the airplane crashed, for example, who would have custody of their children is an issue that you would think they would want to resolve. But it raises all kinds of difficult family issues if you work to resolve them. I don't want your sister to have my children. She's not up to the task. What about your brother? Those sorts of things. And the idea of contemplating your own death is something that a lot of members didn't want to do. Now, we had opposition in the House in particular from 2 prominent figures, the Republican chair of the Judiciary Committee, Jim Sensenbrenner, who had actually, as a young person working in the Wisconsin legislature, witnessed the debate over whether they would have, at the time of the Cold War, successors named by the members of the legislature in case something happened to them. He didn't like it, And he really dug in his heels and became a formidable opponent, partly, I think, just out of stubbornness. And the second was the chair of the Rules Committee, Republican David Dreyer, who had this visceral, emotional reaction. Nobody had ever served in the House of Representatives who had not first been elected. That's what distinguishes the House from the Senate. And he would not, under any circumstances, allow for somebody to serve in the House without first being elected, even in the event of the alternative being no House at all. And that really stopped us in our tracks in terms of getting traction in the House. And I know pretty much for a fact that while we had initial enthusiasm from the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Orrin Hatch, about action here, and I'll talk in a minute about our two champions there, Jim Sensenbrenner went to talk to Orrin Hatch and made it clear that there are a lot of things he could do that would make Hatch's life miserable if he moved on this. So our two champions in the Senate, Republican John Cornyn, along with his then chief staffer, Jim Ho, who's now on the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, and Russ Feingold, the Democrat, actually got a constitutional amendment through the Constitution Subcommittee in the Senate. And it was a particularly heavy lift for Russ Feingold, who had taken the position that he had been against all constitutional amendments because once you allow one, it'll make it easier to have others, but saw the value of this. But we never got any further than that. And as John said with Estes Kefauver, you need champions. You need people who make this a priority. And whether we will have them now, given the other jolt that we've had with the pandemic, is a question we hope to answer in a positive way starting next year.
So on this question of the current moment, so a lot of what we've talked about so far and a lot of what the commission recommended is certainly still relevant in this moment. But there are other aspects of government continuity that are new and different. So how do you see the recommendations that you all made as being right or not for this moment and for the particular continuity challenges that we face now?
Well, we did think about some of the situation we are in today, but to be honest, it probably was not our first thought. We were really thinking about a mass attack that physically hit Washington and people in Washington and killed many people at the same time. You know, we did, of course, think about things like chemical weapons or biological weapons attacks, which would have something of the character of our pandemic today. But it wasn't as much on our minds. And I guess, you know, I think that the simple point is what made this all happen was we cared that there were institutions that we wanted there in the case of a crisis, because having just the presidency or a disabled Congress acting in an emergency was going to lead to a worse outcome, really could lead to some disastrous outcomes. And as much as, you know, Congress is not the most popular institution, having it there after 9/11, being able to either check or reinforce the president and pass laws that are through a more regular process was really, really very valuable. So I think we all agree that Congress needs to have a plan for operating. Of course, there's disagreement today between the parties and between the Senate and the House as to, you know, should members actually be showing up in Washington or not? Or is the current situation too dangerous? I think that's separate from the question of we really need to have a plan. And, you know, just the House has now implemented of some rules changes, which is allowing it to operate with some remote voting by proxy that has allowed some votes to go forward. Republicans are against it. They've had a suit against it. But whether that meets perfect constitutional scrutiny of the quorum or not, I think is the smaller question. The bigger question is we really need a plan. We probably need, you know, both sides to be more serious about buying in. We also need plans for some bigger crises that we have, not just the ones of 9/11, but of the one where nobody could actually come to Washington to meet. Today, we do think that some members are going to be here and we rely on the proxies to some others not, but we could have a situation where literally everybody's alive and well, but they're unable to come to Washington. And that's something, you know, we haven't adequately dealt with. We're starting to grapple with. And I think that's the challenge of the next few months for the current situation, and then also really putting something in place that is there for the next crisis that could deal with those issues.
And here I want to give a tip of the hat to Representative Jim Langevin of Rhode Island, who at a hearing that the House Administration Committee had on some of these issues a couple of years after 9/11, made a strong case for having a capacity for a remote Congress. Now, we didn't give that a lot of priority. We didn't oppose it. At the time, we were a little bit concerned about the slippery slope of members getting so used to being able to operate without having to come back to Washington that they might make it a regular thing. But we also weren't thinking through the impact that this pandemic would have. And that's why, while we were supportive, we didn't push it until recently, when it became clear with this pandemic that having the ability to operate remotely in some fashion was a necessity. It took us back to many of the arguments that I had directly with David Dreyer, who had been a dear friend, where he would say, we can't have a Congress without having everybody first elected. And I said, David, it's not a question of whether you have a Congress that's been elected or a Congress that's been appointed. It's a question of whether you'll have a Congress at all. And in this case as well, at a time when we have this national crisis with a pandemic that could get even worse, we do not want to operate with government by fiat, and that requires some remote capability, and so we focus some on that now. I would add one other area that we considered but didn't do in a separate report, but John and I were particularly active in this, operating without the formality of the commission, and that's continuity of elections. Another issue that's particularly relevant right now. And we wrote pieces about all of the different timeframes. John, of course, has also taken on the responsibility of editing the book After the People Vote that had been started by our late friend and colleague, Walter Burns, looking at all the different places and times in the law and in the Constitution from an election moving forward. And we recognized that there could be disruption of the election, and we had no plans in place there. And in many places, we still don't. And so we're focused, including in a task force on election crises, but in other ways, on trying to make sure that we can have our elections operate with continuity as well.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that's a particularly salient point in this moment. And when you think about some of the issues that the commission did raise about the challenges of filling vacancies, we're also in a moment where, even if that remains the only avenue available to fill vacant House seats, and the nature of the crisis means that it's also not especially safe to hold in-person elections. So it really does present a new set of challenges. And so I want to just pose one last question before we wrap up. You obviously both have extensive expertise in these issues. And so I'd love to hear you just evaluate a little bit what's happened so far in this crisis with institutional responses by Congress, the executive branch, and the courts. Kind of how do you think those institutions have responded to the current moment?
Well, I don't think the courts, the courts have made one change that's obvious to everyone, in the sense that they have gone to oral argument that is remote. And in fact, it's, you know, allowed many more people to have a window into the world of the court in a way that was unexpected. I don't think we've done anything structurally to the courts, but that has been something that they've found a way to operate. And that's, I think, gone quite smoothly. The presidential succession, I don't think we've thought enough about that. Again, I think that factor that Norm brings up, that people don't want to consider their own demise, not only about themselves, but also sometimes they think it's a sign of weakness. We had, throughout our history, all sorts of terrible problems, Woodrow Wilson being incapacitated for a long time and not really wanting to admit it, not wanting to allow that others were making decisions for him. So, you know, I think it is a real psychological issue for anybody holding that office. Look, in Congress, we've had action, but we do have some disagreement. I do want to stress that it's just important to make sure that we feel comfortable that we can operate. And again, the sides do disagree a little bit, thinking one side, Republicans thinking you could actually get here and operate, and Democrats thinking it's not. And the House and Senate are also different. But, you know, I think that's the tip of the iceberg. I do think it's important that we have a plan, and that we have this interim plan that the House has done. I think there are ways in which it's not perfect, but it's only one scenario. And there would be some worse ones with many people being sick and other problems for the Senate that you could imagine. And so Congress in the moment should act, but also it really should reflect and put in place for the next Congress's rules and for the future, ways in which a process known by both parties can be put in place that can operate in these circumstances if needed.
So, you know, if we go back, the initial opposition that we had to action in any of these areas was really concentrated among Republicans. But I'm not going to let Democrats off the hook here. We had some initial interest from then Speaker Denny Hastert and his staff, at least in exploring some of these things, that came to a grinding halt because of Sensenbrenner and Dreyer. But the reality is when Democrats took back the majority in Congress, we got no action in any of these areas either. So this has been a bipartisan failure. And yet what's happened now is that this set of issues, which should involve institutional patriotism and fealty to the fundamentals of our system, have gotten caught up in the tribal wars. And so I know from talking to some and from hearing a lot about others that there are a number of Republicans in the House who have been very receptive to making sure we could operate with remote meetings and votes. And indeed, the problem-solving caucus in the House actually held a session, a sort of trial session of how they could do a debate remotely. But now all of them, every single one, voted against the quite pared-down plan of the chairman of the House Rules Committee, Democrat Jim McGovern, to have these proxy votes and were more resistant to having remote votes, at least initially, because it's become a partisan issue there. Now, in the Senate, you have a very commendable effort to do remote voting, a bill with a threshold, so it would only be in an emergency, that was introduced by Rob Portman, Republican from Ohio, with Dick Durbin, Democrat from Illinois, with bipartisan co-sponsorship. But the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, slammed the door on doing anything of that sort there as well. And again, sort of turning it into a partisan issue. Oh, these Democrats, they're so weak. We have first responders and other critical forces going out there and risking their lives in the pandemic to do the people's business. We should do the same, which I believe is without regard to the reality that, one, many members of Congress are in that age range and have pre-existing conditions where they're vulnerable. Two, they are making, by appearing together and often in close range of one another, their staffs and the other employees of the Capitol and the families of all of those and anybody they come into contact with vulnerable by meeting in person instead of doing it remotely, despite the safeguards they put in place. So we really are not thrilled with the way things have gone. Thank goodness the House finally, after some prodding, took an action, very narrow and constrained, and not quite, I think, what either John or I would prefer if we were going to operate in this way, which is to have not any kind of voting by proxy, but direct votes by people present remotely, if not together in Washington. But at least there was an action taken. But we're not seeing the kind of response that should be there at a time of a pandemic, a response that we see from many other legislatures around the world to be able to function the way they should at a time of crisis in the nation.
All right. Well, thank you, Norm. Thank you, John, for joining me. I think we'll leave the conversation there, but you've given us a lot to think about, and I appreciate the giving us the time today. So thank you.
Thank you, Molly.
Thanks, Molly.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer is Zachary Frank, and the podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patia Howell. Our music is performed by Sophia Young. Please rate and review the Lawfare Podcast wherever you get your podcasts and share it widely. And as always, thanks for listening.
Thank you. Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.